This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. I hope you're having a pleasant day wherever you may be in the world. Joining me today is Carl Radell. Carl Radell is the internet pseudonym of an English author, academic researcher, and perpetual student who holds various degrees in business and modern history and has published several articles and a book or two. His blog is called Semitic Controversies. He first developed an interest in the subject of Jews and Judaism several years ago while he came across the concept of Jewish ritual murder and started researching the case of Saint Simon of Trent in 1475. This led to his break with the skeptic community, who demanded adherence to what Carl regards as a nonsense intellectual position that the Jews could, in effect, do no wrong and that perforce the charges against the Jews of Trent must have been invented. Since then, Carl has made it his life's work to revive an alternative to the state-sponsored philo-Semitism of current academe and pop intellectuals. And today we will discuss a few Semitic controversies, namely Bolsheviks and communist plots. But later we'll talk about more current geopolitical events. Carl Radell, who I know you will enjoy, coming up. Hi, Carl. Welcome. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm really, really good. Thank you very much.
So how are you enjoying the cultural enrichment of England these days?
Well, England is great fun. You know, it's full of Muslims, full of Jews, full of assorted people who come from I don't know where.
Well, your blog is called Semitic Controversy. So when did you first develop an interest in all things Jewish?
I developed it actually when I was doing one of my master's degrees, and I was in a skeptical debate around the subject of Jewish ritual murder, or the blood libel, as it's sometimes called. And I noticed that everyone was going, you know, this can't be true, even though, to me, it was obvious that it could be true. It's quite plausible to be true, but why are you denying even the possibility? So I began looking into the entire Jewish ritual murder thing. And this kind of developed into a broader interest with Judaism, the Jewish question, and so forth. I was already leaning far right anyway, but it's kind of developed into a whole spectrum of interest in to do with how Jews work, how Judaism works, how people misrepresent quite frequently evidence in order to buck up these particular Jewish myths, often which are the standing blocks of Zionism. Like, for example, you know, that Jews have disproportionately contributed to the world, which is complete nonsense, especially if you understand how science works, as in it's incremental work rather than one big inventor going, ah, I invented everything. And also how they play games with our identity. Good examples of which, and if you look at the Nobel Prize lists, for example, they only include Jewishness based upon, a Jewish feeling of the person who's involved. But for example, they'll use people in that list whose grandfather was Jewish or has some Jewish relative or something like that, and they fail to comprehend. First of all, it contradicts their own definition that Jews aren't a race. And second of all, more fundamentally, that it assumes that any Jewish heritage is the cause of brilliancy, mm-hmm. which is rather, when you think about it, it's a rather supremacist sentiment, and it's one that's absolutely at the heart of Zionism and, in fact, Judaism itself. Because after all, remember, Jews believe they are the unique people who are destined to rule the world, to tell the Goyim what to do. And when the Messiah comes, they will be the rulers of the universe, basically.
Well, I wanted to get into Bolshevism. I'm Russian. I had family that died at the hands of Bolsheviks and others that escaped. And it was common knowledge that the early Bolsheviks, the leading figures in the communist seizure of power, along with the murder of Tsar Nicholas II, was led and conducted by Jews like Lenin. So why did he have a special reason to hate Tsar Nicholas II?
Well, the Jews particularly hated the Russians, in large part because the Russians had long, shall we say, I guess the word would be, they had prevented the Jews from from becoming very too powerful, if you will. Because the Jews in Russian history, as you probably know, there is they turned up with Poland. So Catherine the Great, you know, took Poland and then created the Pale of Settlement. So you have all the Jews in this one area, and the logic being that, okay, they want to live amongst themselves, so let's put them there. And they really resented that in the end, because what happened is, and it's not often talked about like this, but basically the way that the shtetl, as it's called, the shtetl is S-H-E-T-H-L. Basically, it's little, means Yiddish for little town, little towns. It's where basically you have rabbis who would basically be tyrants. They would be localized tyrants. They would rule the Jews with an iron fist. And if you go back into all the rabbinics of that period, you find things like what they call the informer rules, which is if you're a Jew and if you informed to the Gentile authorities, then the rabbis would, in quotes, have you tried, and then because they weren't allowed in technicality to have you killed, there would be in quotes a informal mob of Jews who would then go and lynch you. And for anyone who doesn't doubt me, they can go and look up the rabbinic logic of Isaac Luria and Moses Isserles, both of whom are very, very prominent rabbis at the time. But the reason they hated Nicholas particularly was because of the fact that early on, after the death of Alexander, of Tsar Alexander, who was a liberalizing Tsar, at the hands of a not Jewish, Bolshevik kind of semi-Bolshevik conspiracy, the Russian authorities cracked down upon dissenters. They cracked down upon the people who were supporting dissenters, and a lot of the people who were supporting dissenters were Jewish. Now, to give you some idea of that, Erich Haberer, in his 1995 work, Jews and Revolution in 19th Century Russia, said very, very bluntly that Jews played a hugely disproportionate role in the leadership of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, which is the precursor of the Bolshevik Party in many ways, the Russian Social Democratic Party. And to give you some names in that, people like Yevno Azef, who was the leader of the Social Revolutionaries, and his deputies, people like Pinhas Rutenberg. And he, Pinhas Rutenberg, was also, quote unquote, a Zionist, and later, late in his life. And they were the key players who engaged in strikes, lockouts, all this kind of stuff. You know, the bombs, whatever. Because the Tsar would react as the Tsar would, by clamping down again and again and again. And the Jews didn't like that because this was, you know, I want my privileges. I want to be special because I'm Jewish. And it's really important to understand, when trying to understand Jewish history, that for a lot of their history, they've had special privileges. It's often forgotten that, for example, the Romans under Julius Caesar provided the Jews with special privileges, and these were not revoked until they revolted against Rome. And then you had, during the Middle Ages in Europe, Jews had special privileges because Jews were the property of the crown. They were defended by the crown. They could call any crown castle in anywhere in Europe, and they would be admitted and defended by the imperial or the French monarchs or the Spanish monarchs or the English monarchs' troops. And this privileged status continued till through the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, until you kind of get to Russia. And the Jews often talk about how oppressed they were in Russia. But to give you some idea, in 1897, according to Bernard Wasserstein in his 2012 On the Eve, 40% of all merchants in Russia were Jewish, in the Russian Empire were Jewish. And to give you some perspective, that the Jews at the time were 1.36% of the population.
Yep.
That's a fairly scary figure. But then you get into specifics. The Jews were promoted drinking. They owned lots and lots of inns. So famously, people like the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the current Hasidim, was an innkeeper. So how you associate alcohol with mysticism, I don't know, but apparently they do. So kind of you had this kind of hatred growing and growing and growing. And possibly the easiest way to sort of understand that is not necessarily with Russia, but it's more with somewhere like Hungary, mm-hmm. because Russia itself was kind of an odd one because you had the Pale of Settlement. But if you look at somewhere like Hungary, you had a situation which I'll quote you something from Howard Sagar's 2012 Dreamland, where he says very, very bluntly that by 1910, it was estimated that 54% of Budapest's commercial firms were owned by Jews, as were 85% of all Hungarian banks and financial institutions, including the nation's largest, the Commercial Bank of Pest. Indeed, Jewish-owned banks played a decisive role in funding Hungary's commercial and industrial expansion, much of which also was pioneered by Jews. Hungary's sugar industry was dominated by the Hatvany Deutsch family. In textiles, the Goldenberger Works were the nation's largest. Manfred and Berthold Weiss owned the single largest munitions factory in the country and later constructed the nation's first shipyard and several of its largest railroads. As always, education provided the impetus for the Jews' central role in the professions. In 1913, Jews comprised 17% of all students in Hungary's secondary schools, 57% of in the nation's commercial schools, and 46% of the student body at the University of Pest. By then, too, Jews made up 46% of Hungary's journalists, 50% of Hungary's lawyers, 62% of Hungary's private physicians. A significant minority of Jews became particularly politically prominent, although most of these tended to be converts or children of converts to Christianity. Between 1900 and 1918, 26 deputies of Jewish ancestry sat in the parliament, and at least 12 ethnic Jews served as cabinet ministers. That gives you some background as to how powerful the Jews were in Hungary, and that's very similar, as I've sort of stated, with that 40% figure to Russia. But then, what happened in Hungary? Well, who was these very people who were talking about, you know, this, you know, how supportive they were? But it's important to know that even though the Jews were this successful, they supported revolution, they supported socialism, social democracy, disproportionately, in fact. And this is because, as Kevin MacDonald so rightly says, they realized that that any kind of national consciousness, any kind of, shall we say, pro-native sentiment, nativist sentiment, could be bad for Jews, and they weren't going to allow them to dominate quite so much. Where if the Jews did dominate, the history said, okay, you'll dominate for a while, but the Gentiles won't stand it forever. They'll come back and they'll get you.
Mm-hmm.
And so in, of course, after the First World War, you get the situation where all of a sudden you have a communist revolution breaking out. And it's worth quoting what Paul Kellerman in his 2012, The Hungarian Communist Party, Ethno-Nationalism and Antisemitism, in the journal 20th Century Communism has to say, when he says, the Hungarian Communist Party's HCP history was from its inception intertwined with the relationship between Jews and non-Jews. When the party was formed in November 1918, its leader, Béla Kun, and at least 10 of the 17 Central Committee members and 60% of the party members were Jewish. After holding power with the socialists for 133 days, the party was banned, and its leaders, including Kun, lived in exile in the Soviet Union. Kun was executed in 1937 in one of Stalin's purges, probably on suspicion of having Trotskyite sympathies. If his execution was meant as a warning to the rest of the Hungary's communist leadership, it had the desired effect. Mateusz Lakowski would surpass all other party chiefs in the Soviet bloc for his subservience to Moscow. In at least one respect, however, Lakowski did not oblige. And he was himself Jewish, by the way. Notwithstanding Molotov's advice that the Soviet Union's Soviet Union's liberation of Hungary, the Communist Party should be reestablished with non-Jews at its helm. The four leading members of the newly formed Central Committee were to be of Jewish origin. As Molotov anticipated, Jewish prominence in the Communist Party could not but affect the population's perception of communism in a country where in the recent past there had been overwhelming public reaction of indifference to the anti-Jewish laws, etc. The Communist Party's leaders returning to Hungary in 1945 after years of exile in Moscow knew that their efforts to expand the party's social base would be hampered by widespread antisemitism. However, rather than confront anti-Jewish prejudice, the party suppressed the public discussion of matters touching specifically on Jews. Now, doesn't that sound awfully familiar?
Yes, of course it does.
Because yeah. It's suppressing any discussion of Jews, any critical discussion of Jews.
Well, they made it anti-Semitism illegal in the Soviet Union, just as though
one of the first acts they in fact did. It was the their law against racism, basically.
Yeah.
But the main thrust of it was to say, oh no, you can't discriminate against Jews. Jews can't possibly do bad stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important to note too that 90% of these Jews in Russia at this time were returned exiles. So it was a deadly mistake for the Tsar to allow them into Russia, many of whom were political prisoners, wasn't it? Because it was almost like they wanted to get revenge.
Yeah, and one of the weird things about the whole Soviet Union in regards to that was you had this indigenous Jewish group, these indigenous Jewish groups who were quite radical. They were, you know, they were spitting blood, basically. But the leaders came back, and the leaders were just completely off, you know, completely mad, because they'd often been in Siberia for long periods of time, and they kind of self-radicalized. They'd become more and more and more and more radical. And Trotsky's a really good example of that. And one of the things that I have with university colleagues is I often hear things like, oh, Trotsky, he'd have been all right. Well, no, if you read Trotsky's work and you look at his record and you compare that record to Stalin, in fact, Stalin was the saner of the two. Because Trotsky would have gone out and tried to conquer the world and just executed anyone who didn't get who got in his way. Stalin was at the very least a bit more rational than that, although he was a touch on the paranoid side, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Now, we hear the claim that Stalin was anti-Semitic and was trying to purge Jews. Is this true?
Nope. The reason we hear that one is because, and it's, I guess it's a very important point to make, that in order, that's a very superficial understanding of the Soviet Union. And the reason it's a very superficial understanding is because it assumes that because Stalin killed a bunch of Jews in his first and second purges, and then the one after the war, this equals anti-Semitism. But what people don't think about is why Stalin killed lots and lots of Jews. They immediately jumped to it's because he hated Jews. No, Stalin did not hate Jews, nor was Stalin Jewish himself. But what is not known so well is that, for example, we hear of Lenin's new economic policy in the 1921 post-war period to try and help people. But it's often not realized that Jews are disproportionately represented among the people who benefited from the new economic policy. And so when Stalin came back and he went after what he called the kulaks, the NEP men, who did he hit disproportionately? Jews. But also, when we think of Stalin and the Jews, we think of Maxim Litvinov, we think of Lazar Kanovich, we think of Ilya Ehrenberg, we think of Genndik Yagoda. But when we go to the statistics, and this is what I think is really important with Soviet Union, we don't work from individuals, we work from the statistics, because the statistics are scary. And they're also far more demonstrable than saying, okay, the Soviet Union was controlled by Lazar Kanovich or someone like that. But for example, the official statistics in 1930s say the following, that in the 1930s, a quarter of all dentists and pharmacists and doctors in the USSR were Jewish, while a fifth of all lawyers were. Add to that more than half of all Jews were white collar workers in the 1939 USSR. That's more than any other nationality in the USSR, including the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in 1939, they were only 1.3% of the Soviet population. To paraphrase Wasserstein, Jews effectively dominated the USSR's white-collar jobs, from the universities to schools to management positions to the professions, as is shown by the fact that in 1939, 87% of Soviet Jews lived in, you know, the major Soviet cities. After all, as Wasserstein says on page 62, Jews were simply not proletarians. Even more revealing is that in 1939, according to the official statistics, some 10% of the Soviet Communist Party was Jewish. 10%. European Jews were extremely prominent in European Communist parties. Good examples are people like the founder of the Dutch Communist Party, who was David Wijnkoop, who was the son of a rabbi, and the chief ideologue of the French Communist Party in the 1930s, who was called Eugen Fried, who was a Slovakian Jew, and he more or less forced Stalinist orthodoxy onto the French Communist Party. But when you get even further than that, you find that there's been a very, very important piece of academic research done by Sheila Fitzpatrick in the last couple of years. What she did is she analyzed Stalin's appointment book from 1930 to 1940. And what she found truly sinks any argument that Stalin was anti-Semitic. She said that when she looked at it, 75 to 90% of those coming to the dictator had Jewish surnames in 1930s, 1940s. Now think about that period. That's when you've got the anti-Trotsky, you've got the anti-transcript purges raising, you've got the Ukrainian famine, the Holodomor raging, you've got another purge going on, you've got Stalin declaring war on various different places, and killing people, killing kulaks. But yet, if he's killing Jews, but hang on a second, Jews are the ones who were talking to him. So, hang on a minute. So doesn't that mean actually Stalin is not anti-Semitic? Stalin is killing capitalists, is basically killing Jews who are profiteering with Jews who are communists.
Yep.
And that's in itself something that is often completely forgotten. Stalin was a very orthodox Marxist. And by that, I mean he was a true believer. He believed in assimilationism. And this is something that Stalin's anti-Semitic argument completely forgets. That Stalin, that in the USSR and Marxism in general, nationality doesn't matter. Nationality is pointless. You know, if I'm black, I'm white, I'm whatever, I'm Jewish, it doesn't matter. You are a Soviet citizen. You are part of the proletariat.
Lenin was that way too. Cultural loyalties didn't matter. Actually, I found a quote. He said, "An intelligent Russian is almost always a Jew or someone with Jewish blood in his veins." And he had contempt for non-Jews and his own countrymen. So he didn't care about culture or folk.
No. Nope, he didn't. And that's important, the point to make, because the entire Stalin was anti-Semitic argument assumes that Stalin wasn't a real Marxist. But in fact, he was. He truly believed that you didn't have to be, you could be anything and be part of, you know, be part of the great Soviet experiment in Marxism. And you can see that after the war, for example, when you have these purges going on. Now, everyone always talks about, for example, the later purges, the attack on the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, who, by the way, are majorly responsible for the Holocaust story. And then also the rootless Cosmopolitans purge, and then the Doctor's Plot from 1949 to about 1953 when he died. But what's forgotten in that is that Stalin had initiated a purge of what he called culturally disloyal elements in 1945. And it only hits Jews in 1948, 1949. Now, this was headed by a man named Andrei Zhdanov, who one of his Stalin's cultural czar. And he would go around, he went around these different things, and he was literally crushing dissenting writers, people who had, in the war, had come to identify with different causes. Now, the big one with the Jews was Zionism. And the fact that you now have a new Zionist state taking shape in the form of Israel. So the USSR, first thing the USSR does is to recognize it. Recognize the state exists. It's wonderful. Okay, fine. If we can use it as part of our great Soviet empire, all the better. But then the Communist Party fails in the first elections. They fail to get anywhere near what the Soviet Union was hoping for. So the Soviet Union basically rejects the Communist Party in Israel to a point and says, no, this is an imperialist venture against the Arabs, imperialist colonialist venture against the Arabs, etc. And then Stalin proceeds to begin to look at the problem of the Jews, because we have a state which is basically identifying itself as a Jewish homeland. But Stalin has a population of people who identify as Jewish. And what he's looking for at this point is to say, does someone identify themselves as Jewish rather than communist? As communist. Sorry, as Jewish rather than part of, you know, Soviet Union. And there were a lot of people who were hit by it who had identified themselves as Jewish and had, when were, and in some way, you know, had used that Jewishness to further their in their work or further their careers, etc. And effectively, a situation where you've got a bunch of people, a bunch of Jews who are loyal to the assimilationist trend in Jewish thought, trying to purge the people who are more nationalistic. They're adhering to the whole idea of the autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic, as in we have all these national states, little national states part of the USSR, and it would be democratic that way, and or we want to go to Israel. So you kind of get a situation where you've got one side of the Jews purging the other side of the Jews, and the same applies in the post-war Cold War scenario, where you hear a lot of talk about how the Jews were persecuted in the Soviet Union because they were not allowed to go to Israel. Well, that's obvious what's actually happened there, because what's happened is people have said, well, I'm a Soviet citizen. I'm not a Jew. I'm a Soviet citizen. So therefore, my Jewishness doesn't actually matter. If you're part of the party's apparat, that's what you do. But if you were young, rebellious, and whatever, I'm Jewish. You know, I've got a Jewish identity. I associate with Zionism. And then you have one side of the party attacking, one part of the party attacking the dissidents, and it just so happens that they're both disproportionately Jewish, as it turns out. I mean, less so as it go. The party became less so as it went on, but it was still disproportionate pretty much to the end.
Now, if we back up a little, do you think murder of Tsar Nicholas in 1918 was a defining moment for European nationalists at that time? So maybe they thought, we need fascist parties now to combat this force.
Yeah, because if you think about it, Stalin, it was the moment of the age when, hang on a second, he was murdered horrifically, as it happens, and he was murdered without warning by actually an entirely Jewish apparat. So it reverberated around Europe, and because you had lots of these white Russian emigres in like places like Germany, you had them in England, France, whatever, they effectively at that point just went sort of cranked it up a gear, if you like, because people said, well, if they're going to murder the Tsar, they're going to murder us. And then what happened is that it became confirmed, because you had all these reports coming out of Russia of Bolshevik killings. And as I said, as it went on, it got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. So effectively, you're right. It did galvanize an age. And particularly bear in mind that just as the Tsar was killed, the Protocols of Zion came out pretty much and were beginning to gain popularity. They're a whole different subject, but it's a kind of perfect storm. You have a situation where you have the Balfour Agreement, which has just said, okay, Jews, we're going to have a state.
1914, right?
Agreement. 1917, the Balfour Agreement. But you know, the World War I just happened. Jews were, in spite of all the claims, Jews were not big on the whole war thing, and they slunk off as far as they could. The official stats tell you that. They were disproportionately not awarded medals. They were disproportionately not involved in the frontline operations, etc. But the Balfour Agreement effectively said, okay, after however many thousand years, 1,900 years, there's going to be a Jewish state, because the British have said that this is this great idea. While then you have the protocols come out, then you have the trauma of World War I as well, and then you've got the Tsar is murdered. And the Tsar is murdered by, the reports come out, and it turns out the Tsar was murdered by the actual chain was Yakov Yulovsky, who is the head of the House of Special Purpose, who was ordered by Philip Goldstein, a.k.a. Isai Adzanovich, who is the member of the presidium of the Urals Regional Soviet, who was ordered by Yakov Sverdlov, and who in turn was ordered by Lenin. And every single one of those individuals is Jewish. So the original point is, yes, it does. You know, it was the defining moment of an age, in the same way that 9/11 was the defining moment of ours, I suspect, more than anything else. It created a climate of fear, of that something is that something bad is happening in the world, and that, you know, that there is, that we're, that everyone is at some kind, in some sense, at war. Question with whom? And this is exactly the same question that nationalists had to answer in the...
If we zoom out and look at other events in the timeline, I put together something here. Let me read. 1848, we had the Jewish emancipation. Then 1914 comes World War One, and then 1915 comes the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, basically destabilizing the Middle East, paving the way for Israel. 1917, you have the Bolshevik Revolution. Then in 1929, there's the Jewish-engineered stock market crash and Great Depression, which meant a massive transfer of wealth from the people to elite bankers. 1945, we have World War II, which we'll talk about later. And then 1948, the founding of the Jewish State of Israel, which basically can translate to destabilize Europe and the world, destroy England's main competitor, Germany, since England was mostly under Jewish control, slaughter as many Gentiles as possible, and then establish the State of Israel.
Yep, and then I guess the only thing that's missing there is the fact that they effectively used the Second World War as a spring, but they in many ways caused the Second World War because they were the ones who effectively they engineered the scenarios. Because when you look at the people, for example, a lot of the people who were advocating war, there was a whole industry in Jewish writers who wrote under pseudonyms as either journalists or authors, who created a whole victim industry about, you know, oh, we're suffering, oh, we're suffering, oh, we're suffering, oh, how could you possibly think that, you know, that we don't deserve a state? And it's something they pioneered a long, long time ago, a long, long, long time ago. But it's just incredible, really, when you think about how much they achieved in that time period.
Yeah.
And also the fact that, bearing in mind that they were the ones at the head, they were basically still at the head of the Soviet Union in many ways. They were at the head of Israel. They were creating Israel. They were in the United States. They were making bounds like never before, as well as also being, so many of them being spies of the Soviet Union. And then you would have in Britain, you had the whole, there was a lot of Jewish, there was Jewish terrorist groups in Britain, actually, one called the 43 group, and various other groups like that. So you had Jews running riot, and it's often forgotten. All these little events of that time are often forgotten. And one I'd like to bring up, just because it just appalls me that no one talks about this, is that the Israeli national poet Abba Kovner had a plan with his Nakim, who was a partisan group. And he tried to poison the water supplies of a bunch of German prisoners of war camps in order to slaughter 6 million Germans. Was his great idea. He was going to slaughter 6 million Germans. He was stopped, but the British just basically kicked him out of the country. They didn't, you know, it wasn't considered a bad thing to want to slaughter 6 million Germans, even though at the time the Russians were insisting basically on slaughtering Germans to the point where it just became insane. You had the Morgenthau plan going on, and you know all that lovely stuff that was on there. And that particular period in time is just it's like a blank space for a lot of people. It's almost like 1930s. They think it's Hitler-centric. It's the rise of the Nazis. Well, hang on a minute. You've got Stalin killing like 10 million people over there. You've got...
Germany was trying to do something about it. That's why I don't understand how all of a sudden people side against Nazis and side with communists.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of the World War II was a good war.
Yeah.
Really, for who? I mean, whose war was it? Who benefited from that war? And who were the ones who were disproportionately involved in advocating genocide quite a lot of the time? Jews. I mean, for example, Joachim Hoffmann in his Stalin's War of Extermination, I think 1998, noted in one of his appendices that when you get to someone, when you look at the people who were in the Soviet Union, who were advocating mass murder, they were almost invariably Jewish. And like, for example, the 1941, the head of the Red Army paper at the time, I can't remember his name, top of my head, basically said, exterminate them all. And this was, you know, this and this was before any alleged atrocities, anything like that. The Red Army was already screaming, kill them all. I don't care who they are, just kill them all. And it's in line with how they behaved in places like Estonia, Moldova, Latvia, and then in the Ukraine as well, after they retook it. But, you know, even Finland. These people had no compunction about slaughtering thousands upon thousands of people for no other reason than they might be an enemy spy. So they would kill them. And they were just counter-revolutionaries, or they were religious, or they were something. It was to the point where it was a man himself in Jewish, Vadim Berstein, in his book on Smersh, said rather pointedly that Stalin and the Soviet Union can only be understood as like a gangster underworld, people who were operating as if in the gangster underworld, where it's not about you having done something wrong, it's about a quota. So they were literally taking people off the street to kill them because they had a quota. Because if they didn't do it, they'd be killed because they'd be on someone else's quota.
Now, at one time, Churchill, he was against Bolshevism. He was saying it's a worldwide conspiracy. And I know David Irving has actually written a book about this. But eventually, the Jews turned him. They bought him and they got him to go attack Germany.
Weird thing about Churchill, in many ways, is the fact that there is an idea that he was in some way anti-Jewish. But if you read his original article, I can't remember the article from, which cites Nestor Webster, he actually differentiates. He says, Zionist Jews are good Jews, Bolshevist Jews are bad Jews. So he was actually then, he was saying that I support Zionism, but I don't support Bolshevism. But it's a conflicting worldview and, you know, how it would all work. But Churchill, as time went on, appears to have got more and more philo-Semitic, to the point where he is now, of course, worshipped by American conservatives, by Brits, by French, by all these people. And I often ask people, why do you worship this man? Have you read a book on him? And the answer is often no. They've read they've read basically nothing. They've read an internet profile, or they've heard what they've heard in their education, or whatever. And they're always shocked to know things about Churchill. Like, for example, he was a profligate. He was a drunk, a serial drunk. He overate. He ordered the mass gassing of Arabs. He did, you know, all this lovely stuff Gallipoli as well, another one, and all the sort of things that he did. And during the 1930s, all he screamed was, kill Germany, kill Germany, mm-hmm. kill Germany. And his thing was always, any threat, perceived threat to Britain was a threat to him. And he perceived Zionism as being, in his words, it would be a part of the British Empire. So it would be a kind of client state of the British Empire, this Zionist little Timpot state. But he never counseled on the fact that the Jews were far more powerful than even he gave them credit for. And it's something that's been commented on before, that some people who have a kind of belief that Jews are powerful don't really put that into practice. They just assume that they can write about it but not actually think about it. About, say, if Jews are powerful, then does that not mean that if you think you're going to dominate them, they're probably going to end up dominating you? And that's actually what's happened. And Churchill was remarkably without foresight in general. And yet, in the 1930s, I think it was 1936, he became bankrupt at some point. And it was a Jewish financier and a friend of his who helped him out, who helped him to live through those bad times. And at that point, he became more and more radical in his kind of kill, start a war now, kill Germany, deal with the Hun, whatever. And he stopped. He talked a bit about Russia, but he didn't really. He kind of forgot about the Soviet Union. And then in the middle of World War II, he just said, "Oh yeah, Soviet Union, my friend." And It's one of the most bizarre moments in modern history, I think, when Churchill, who had spent a lot of time denouncing Soviet intentions, suddenly said, "Ah, Soviet Union, my friend. Stalin, mass murderer. Oh no, he's a good man. He fights for freedom." Really?
Well, America did the same thing. I mean, it was the McCarthy era just for show? Were all the communists running America at that time?
Effectively, yes. Because McCarthy, with the best will in the world, McCarthy's the man who, I can't remember his name, don't mind, forgive me for that. McCarthy's aide, who was the man who came up with all the lists of communists that he was going to attack, and actually was the man who caused him to overreach, was himself an ex-Jewish communist. I can't remember the top of his name. I think it was Benjamin Gitten or something. And he served as that. He was the man who more or less sunk McCarthy, even though McCarthy was, broadly speaking, right. Because in the 1930s, in the Roosevelt regime, effectively, Jews ran America. And this was well known, as you can, for example, read in the memoirs of people like Revel Oliver. You know, it's quite well known that the Jews had were massively powerful. So you had the Morgenthau dynasty. You had all these different people who later turned out to be spies in the various work programs set up by Roosevelt. And you also had, as it happens, you had other people who were spies for nascent Zionism, doing the same thing, but in sort of what Americans would they call patriotic sabotage or something like that. It was a bizarre situation because the Communist Party of America was so incredibly Jewish as an organization. From 1919 to 1926, its basic leadership was about always a third to a quarter Jewish, even though the communists were supposed to be for the people, whatever they were. In fact, they were just basically a bunch of ne'er-do-wells and Jews, effectively, in their sort of little corner, shouting, screaming abuse, and then creating an underground appellat to funnel information and that sort of thing to the USSR. And it's worth remembering that the famous secret speech of Khrushchev was a major thing at that particular point in time, and because it signaled a massive change in the internal working of the USSR. But that was delivered to the US, to the United States, the copy was delivered by a Jewish communist to the nascent Israeli Mossad, to the United States CIA. So at that time, two things happened. First of all, you have a kind of proof that Stalin was partially right. Jews were working for Israel, or for the Jewish, for this new Jewish state within the USSR as spies at quite a high level. Because in order to get that secret speech, you had to remember the presidium. You had to remember the Central Party Congress. And that's not the kind of place you're going to find someone who's low in rank. That's someone who's very, very high up in the Communist Party of Russia. But that then allowed, but that it was that moment whereby the Jews sold them, the Jewish nascent Mossad sold themselves to the CIA as a source of information on the USSR. And that was in many ways how they became affiliated. It was that moment.
Yeah. I know you've written about how they ran numerous spy and espionage networks for the Soviet Union within the US, but there's a TV show running right now called The Americans, produced by a former CIA officer, Joe Weisberg, a Jew. Are you familiar with that one?
I've heard of it. I haven't actually watched it, so.
Well, I wanted to talk about communist splinter groups because, I mean, thinking in terms of like liberalism, which appears more Fabian or Marxist, is this the new totalitarian regime destroying the West using words like tolerance and diversity? But of course, we know they're the opposite of this. So what are your thoughts on Western liberalism today and where it's going?
Well, I always liked, it's a British politician called Nigel Farage. He said in 2013, he said, "Today we have three parties, but we have three parties who promote the same values, social democracy. And he's basically right. We have, effectively, the communists of today are liberals, because liberals, the so-called liberals, because they're basically, they are a old school cultural socialist kind of type. They're not interested in the economics of socialism, apart from as a kind of ideal where they can kind of, you know, have fun with pretending it would work. But liberalism has become this kind of, from being what we now call libertarianism, which was original liberalism, this kind of, if you will, totalitarian idea whereby you have to silence your opponents, because if you have to silence them, if you don't silence them, they might influence someone else, which is in many ways one of the most bizarre things I've ever really read about in all my time reading history, of reading about modern politics and where the way and your as to where it's going. I think we're going to get more and more and more down this path of totalitarian liberal rule. But I do think that there is a lot of signs for hope now. There's a lot of parties out there who are really, really fighting hard. And people like Jobbik in Hungary, people like the Golden Dawn in Greece, people, I mean, even the poor MPD in Germany who suffer persecution that hasn't been seen in a long, long time, still do pretty well considering. There's the Swedish Democrats who have even come out with vaguely anti-Jewish ideas in public and not been too killed for it in the polls. Unfortunately, the French National Front appear to have gone somewhat south lately, but there's definitely signs for hope around, and I kind of draw hope from the successes that we're seeing, and the fact that even though a lot of these are quite milk drinkers compared to what is needed, the fact that they're gaining support might just allow nationalist alternatives to arise, or where there are nationalist alternatives, they're often at the edge of government. People like Jobbik, Golden Dawn again are very much up there. But as your point about liberalism, it's going to get worse before it gets better. In terms of the idea itself, it seems to be that it's basically communism without calling it communism. It's the old cultural, it's what they call Eurocommunism. Because I don't know how much you know about communist theory, but there is, you have Orthodox Marxism, you have Marxist-Leninism, but then you have other things. You have all these things like Maoism, you have whatever. And all of them are defined, largely speaking, by who they view as the proletariat, who they view as the revolutionary class. So Marxist-Leninists view them as the proletariat, the Maoists view it as the peasants, but Eurocommunists view that they have two classes they view. One is minorities, the other one is students. They view those two classes, they call them, as the revolutionary classes. Therefore, what they do in true Gramscian style is they broaden their canvas. So they redefine how they say things. They don't argue about economic inequality so much. They don't talk about, you know, Marxist theory of surplus value or the Marxist theory of alienation anymore. They talk about, you know, the racism caused by, you know, caused by some person who said a bad word once to someone who happened to be black. Because that is part of their thing, because what they want to do is create almost Thomas More's utopia, you know, where everyone was wearing grey, everyone did the same, everyone had the same as everyone else, but everyone's the same, but the intellectuals rule. Effectively, it's a classic one where you create a situation like in Brazil. You have this massive great underclass of people who are dumb, ignorant, and just generally a mishmash of everything that has turned up on the shores. But then you have this class above them who are an elite, and they're an elite, they're an economic elite, they're an intellectual elite, they're a social elite, and they're also a political elite. So they control everything that goes on. It's a form of colonialism, basically. They then get to dictate to everyone else what goes. What goes, you know, I'm superior because I can look at this child's drawing and see a great work of art. Or I'm superior because I can write an awful novel that has, or I am superior because I hold the idea of human progress to be central and I deny basic biology. Or whatever. It's this idea that they cannot be questioned because they're not secure in being questioned. Because their ideas come from a religious impulse. And it's worth noting that a lot of communists through the years either come from a very religious background or have gone back to that. So people like, you know, famously Whitaker Chambers, a lot of the American communists did that, and they still do every now and again. A lot of the communists in Latin America were religious. For example, the famous Jesuits who advocated national liberation as part of Jesus's mission, etc. It's all part of this grand idea to reshape society, to create a utopia that, I guess, could never have been created by, you know, economic means. Because let's face it, the socialist economics was by about 1970, it was completely dead in the water. It had failed abysmally. It had failed in every single state it had been tried. And people were saying, well, orthodox Marxism obviously doesn't work. So we need to have this kind of sort of semi-capitalist but social justice-y kind of model. Let's kind of go differently to that. Let's create a different society based upon that. And in many ways, it's been that kind of focus on less on the economics, more on the cultural side of things, that's created this kind of totalitarian attitude of you should not dare to speak out on such and such a subject. And effectively, we now have in Europe and in the United States the same censorship that they had in the Soviet Union. It's just, it's less, as Thomas Wernicke once noted, it's just less honest. It's self-censorship. It's about, you know, you wouldn't dare write something racist because you'll get looked at, you'll get locked up, or you'll lose your job, or you'll lose status, or you'll do whatever, something will happen to you. And Sweden is a great example, as I'm sure you know. For example, a university professor wrote a bad comment about immigrants on a blog, on a perfectly anonymously on a blog. So the Swedish police went and hunted him down, found him, and then got video cameras out and publicly shamed him to say, you wrote a bad comment about immigrants. Here's his opinion. I'm sure he had a reason for it because he's got a PhD. He's not stupid. But yet they treat anyone who has an opinion contrary to their own as inherently dangerous, subversive, must be gotten rid of.
This show is called Troll Hunter, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. But it's just kind of, I often think we are going to end up in a situation very similar to the Soviet Union, where dissidents are regarded as mentally ill. And we're a long part of the way there now already, because there's a lot of this literature, and I'm sure you're aware of it, that basically is trying to link any kind of prejudice, racism, whatever, to mental illness. Which is ironic, considering that the man who these people cite, Michael Foucault, who is a faggot, but there you go. He argued that mental illness was completely subjective. So they argue that, in fact, you're mentally ill because we're completely subjectively suggest that you're mentally ill. So thus, they use a hard definition when it comes to their opponents, but in terms of themselves, they claim that it's all just, it's all about whatever the state dictates. And which is quite bizarre in terms of their own thinking.
It's like 1 + 1 = 3. 1 + 1 = 3, right? Yes. Trying to reprogram you. White doesn't exist. You don't see differences, you know. Deep program.
it's getting crazier, definitely. And it just feels that, you know, something's going to break. And I think something is breaking because, I mean, I remember when I saw Rudy Giuliani, whatever we may think of him, when he came out and said, it's a war on white people, he got shouted down by anyone. But It was like someone has said it. Someone has broken that iceberg. And if you remember back to 2006, when Amir Sharma Walt came out with their paper on the Israel lobby, that, you know, that broke the dam. It finally broke the dam that Jews can have power in Middle East. And the Jews came out big time and attacked it, but they never won because they could never retract the fact that these are academics, they're serious people, and that they'd written a very, very serious book. So they always, everything they tried failed. And the same has happened with the entire, you know, the sort of the liberal narrative, effectively. The dam has been broken by a series of events. Things like, for example, Trayvon Martin, the more recent one, I can't remember, Ferguson, whatever his name was there. Oh, Michael Brown, that was it. All these events and the just extreme reaction to them, and the fact that they clamped down on dissent, they were trying to present a counter-narrative, which it was abysmal. It failed, and obviously failed, has actually got people talking about the one thing they didn't want you to talk about, which was race. They didn't want to talk to you about immigration. They didn't want to talk about all these different things that they now are in a situation where they're ignoring it, but you can see there's an undercurrent going on. There's people that are talking about this kind of thing now. They're saying, I want to talk about the fact that black people murder people in mass numbers and no one talks about it. But then someone kills a black person. Oh, the world has come to an end. The same with Jews. Over the years, I've heard an increasing amount of comments about the Holocaust in historical circles, because it's not very well known, but among historians, the Holocaust area is considered a bit of a joke, really. Because if people believe it, people believe in the Holocaust, but we all know what the Holocaust crowd are like, because they are basically considered to be really, really odd. You know, they kind of you push them off into a corner and just go, okay, you go over there, we'll talk serious history here. Because they go on and on and on about these weird theories. I mean, I'll give you an example. In a book on Applebaum's book Gulag. It's about the Soviet camps, post-war Soviet camps. She basically spends the entire introduction trying to explain why Stalin's atrocities are not nearly as bad as the Holocaust. And I just remember reading that, and I gave it to a friend of mine who's a tenured academic, and he read it and looked at me, and we both laughed because it was so contrived.
But she's not going to go to jail for saying that. But no, question the Holocaust, straight to jail.
I know, and that's something I always like to point out to people, is that if Holocaust originism was half as shall we say quirky as you know, just easily debunked as Jews and people, various skeptics claim, then why do these people react differently to it? There's no logical reason why someone would say, okay, you can create a conspiracy theory about, you know, Stalin not committing atrocities, which can be easily debunked, and that's not illegal. But then you say something about the Jews and the Jews not being Holocausted, people go, well, you know, you should be able to debunk the claims. But they don't. They don't. And as I think, since then, it's the 90s, that is in mid 90s when they were desperately, that there'd been a series of engagements between revisionists and the inquisitive skeptic community and Orthodox historians, that basically the decision was almost taken, oh, we're not going to engage them in conversation. And the reason why was because it turned out that the Holocaust deniers, in quotes, knew more about the Holocaust than the Holocaustians. And that's continued, because someone like Carlo Mottone has a scary, quite frankly, frightening amount of knowledge about the Holocaust. He knows more than just about any other person on the planet about it. And he knows documents. He speaks like 6, 7, 8 languages now. He translates all his documentation on his own. And it's all this kind of, it's this kind of thing where they don't want to engage. And the reason they don't want to engage is because they can't debunk it. Because it's so obvious when you look at it from a critical perspective that the Holocaust is a complete is a bunch of, well, sorry, nonsense. You know, it's okay. Jews were put in camps. We all know that. Jews died. Okay, we all know that. What did they die of? There lies in the problem, because there's no documentation. There's no nothing which says, you know, they were gassed. They were done. As I, you know, as the old challenge to the anti-revisionists go, and the anti-revisionists go, sorry, you know, show us one document which says this particular Jew was on such and such a day killed by the Germans as part of X program.
Mm-hmm.
This is an incredibly ordered society. This is one that is very well known among World War II historians for producing lots and lots and lots of information.
We're talking about fascists here. They're mm-hmm. pretty organized. Indeed.
Yeah. And to the point where I think it was John Mosier, who's a professor of English, who for some reason has written three very, very good books on World War One, World War Two, and World War Two history from a German perspective. And he said rather bluntly that you can't trust Soviet statistics because everyone knows that they were massaged like anything, because mm-hmm. Marxists believe that all truth is malleable. But yet, you look at the German statistics. The German statistics, when we compare them to the Allied statistics, are broadly speaking right. The real Allied statistics versus the German statistics, you look at their right. So we know that the German statistics are largely speaking going to be quite balanced. They're going to be quite careful. So we compare them. We compare what the Germans compiled about all these different subjects, and we know that they're fairly, really accurate, and it makes sense. You then look at that in terms of, in quotes, atrocities, and you start looking that all of a sudden that we go away from the documents and we go straight to, I saw my friend get gassed 25 times and they failed and he ran over a fence and lived with wolves for 10 years kind of thing. That seems to be the way that we've gone in terms of the whole Holocaust thing. They've gone away from the gas chambers. They've gone away from Auschwitz in many ways, which you may or may not have noticed. A lot of historians now are very, very quietly trying to push the gas chambers away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the reason why is because anyone who's had any historical training knows that they are cherry picking confession, they're cherry picking statements from different survivors. They're not using the whole statement. They're using bits of different statements to add together a picture, as is supposedly a theory. And then they're trying to make it fit. And the problem is they can't really make it fit because it doesn't really work. So they're trying to move away from the whole idea of gas chambers and towards death by bullets, as they call it. So that in the Einsatzgruppen killed, 4 million Jews by shooting them, because at least that is physically possible. Whereas the Jews, for example, have been incredibly loud about they will not allow this to go away, because the minute you take away the gas chambers, the minute you take away the Holocaust as such, or the Jews, becomes just another killing done in that particular epoch, and it's not even a big one.
Yeah, it's nothing compared to what the communists
Stalin was doing, or even what the Allies and the Soviets did after the Second World War to Germans.
Right. That's right. Even raping women and burning children alive, torturing people. I mean, it's horrific.
It is. And if your listeners really want to look into it, there's been a couple of really good books written about it recently. Thomas Goodrich's Hellstorm.
We know.
And I can't remember the author. There's an academic who's written the Greatest Part Odious or something. It's a book about how the Germans were treated by the Soviet Union after the war, and it makes fairly horrific reading. People I've read a couple of Holocaust books, and the books are they're quite dry. There's not a lot of anecdote because they don't talk about the anecdotes, because the anecdotes make them look really stupid, but. When you talk about all the stuff that happened to the Germans, and it's not just the Germans, actually, it's basically you had anyone who was regarded to be the enemy suffered to a huge extent. That, I mean, the French famously basically lined up anyone who was in any way pro Vichy or pro the Axis and shot them or killed them in other various ingenious ways. And they raped the women and either killed them or shaved their heads.
Yeah, 100,000 was speculated.
Yep, plenty of, there's been a, there was a lot of death involved in that particular point in history. And it's just kind of, it's that kind of getting back to, you know, kind of getting a sense of balance, really, that's lacking in discussions of the, in quotes, persecution of the Jews. Because after all, the Germans were in the middle of a major war. Why would they be gassing?
Exactly.
You know, it just doesn't make any sense. But then when you go into the details, it makes even less sense. You know, sort of the, in quotes, pure death camps that were sending people to Buchenwald. That's what people would go from, like, Buchenwald to Treblinka, then to Maidenbeck, then somewhere else. And it's like, well, you've just passed through two death camps, in quotes.
Yeah. How does that? I get so tired of hearing, you know, oh, persecution, but never why, what you were doing, what caused you to be thrown out, why people were starting to hate you. That's never looked at.
Yeah, I know. It's something, for example, at Ossenter Quarterly, that you see quite a lot of, there's quite a lot of thought about that going on, because people are saying, well, from kind of an intellectual perspective, because they're saying, well, you know, really, if you read Jewish history books, you can tell why that is the case, because the Jewish history books will tell you. But what doesn't happen is they don't actually come into popular history, and it's kind of framed differently. It's kind of, oh, it's a persecution complex. It was you. It was kind of everyone ganged up against the very successful Jews, or it was irrational, or something like that. The latest one, I think, is certainly one of the best I've heard. And Alan Dershowitz has been parroting it a lot, is the idea that anti-Semitism is completely unrelated to Jews. Because, for example, in Japan, there was anti-Semitism. Well, hang on a minute. Doesn't that mean because the Japanese thought that Jews were a bad thing, could be a bad thing, that means that they were possibly reacting to something that they saw happening in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily something that they themselves had experienced, but something that on their analysis upon documentation, whatever, on what was going on in the world, they understood and saw, and so forth. But it's just the way they write about it. I mean, one of the weirdest ones I've been coming up against recently, twice actually in the last 2 years, has been the assertion, from a Jew, one from not, that Karl Marx wasn't Jewish. Karl Marx was a Christian. And that's by two very serious authors in two academic books, one Jewish, one not. And Karl Marx was an anti-Semite who hated Jews.
Oh, because he wrote the book The Jewish Question, right?
Yeah, that's the reason. That's the reason they use. They say, oh yeah, because his father converted to Protestantism when he was very, very young. He therefore wasn't Jewish. But in fact, Marx's mother never converted. Never ever. She died rather than convert. And it's kind of that. It's this kind of industry in trying to just someone who in quotes bad isn't Jewish, or it just happens to be Jewish. Like, for example, in the USSR, as we've been discussing, the classic response is not everything. Lots of the Bolsheviks were Jews, but not every Jew is a Bolshevik. Well, if Jews are disproportionately Bolshevik, then, and the Jews don't denounce those Jews as being Jews who have been bad, which they didn't to a large extent, then really, whose fault is that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Whose fault is it that, you know, all these horrible killings happened in sort of that kind of period of time? It's the very people who are the ones who are saying, oh, no, we're persecuted. But that's what the Jews have been saying since, well, I think, since the Roman Empire. If you read Josephus, you find that very same strain. We are persecuted. We're wonderful. We're a wonderful people. We do this. And I'm going to attribute all these wonderful qualities to the Jews, but nothing ever is bad. I mean, every other culture I know of produces criticism of themselves. Criticism that they will tolerate, you know, of themselves. So they'll criticize themselves. Others will criticize them. They don't. For example, if someone criticizes Germans or the Germans don't respond by saying you're Germanophobic. The Germans will just respond in turn. They'll say, okay, oh, that's valid. That isn't valid. I respond this way. But Jews just scream, that's evil. You can't possibly criticize us, because we are above criticism. And it's something you see quite a lot in Jewish thinking as well. It's this idea that anything to do with Jews and Judaism is inherently right.
Mm-hmm. It relates it's the back to the one idea. True way.
Yes, it's the one true way that, you know, the world. I mean, the good examples from the Kashrith, where they believe they get these variable claims going on, that it was like the healthiest diet known to man, designed by God, or Shishishta is the humanest way to kill animals because it was designed by God, would be the undertext of that, and they come up with all these intricate ways of trying to justify this particular claim, without referring to what the actual base is, which is the idea that they are the chosen people. They should rule everyone in the world, which is, by the way, the basic logic of Judaism, of any form, reform, reconstructionist, orthodox, Hasidic, whatever. That's the logic they use, is that Jews are higher soul beings. They are, I think it was a rabbi I was reading the other day, Rabbi Binyamin Forst, fairly senior new rabbi in New York, said in one of his books, oh yeah, by the way, Jews are they're kind of the evolved soul people of humans. They're the evolved sons of Eve and Adam and Eve. Whereas the Gentiles are the unevolved ones. They're the ones who are kind of, well, they're stuck in evil, you know, they do all the bad things the Talmud says about them and so forth.
Well, then if they feel that way, go to Israel. don't live where we live.
I know, it's like blacks, isn't it, in many ways, if you think about it. It's that classic thing where they go, oh yeah, I live in a racist state. Well, hang on a minute, you could go emigrate.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's that bad, go live in Liberia, go live in, actually don't live in South Africa, please, because poor old boars.
Oh yeah, I know, it's awful. Well, Carl, please give us your website and any other details you want to share.
Well, my website is http://semiticcontroversies@.blogspot.com. That is, and of course, I, as usual, on my email, carl.raddle@gmail.com. If anyone has any particular questions or the usual barrel of insults I occasionally get, you know, you're an anti-Semite Nazi who wants to, you know, kill 6 million Jews, or my favorite one lately, either I'm a liberal or I'm a Muslim.
Okay.
How that works, I don't know. But allegedly, I converted to Islam, or I'm an Arab pretending to be someone else, or something or other of that nature. You know, usual crazy stuff.
Yeah, because it's always polarized, right? If you're against the Jews, you're an Arab, and if you're for the Arabs, you're with the Jews. It's like, no, I don't want anything to do with any of them.
Yeah. Best thing is when you get someone suggesting that you have a direct line to Satan, or you're in fact possessed by Satan, and that they're going to try and exorcise you. That's my favorite ever.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Well, folks, I'm going to leave you with something different today. A 10-minute commentary from the late Dr. William Pierce called How It All Fits Together. Have a great night.
Hello. We've talked about many subjects on these American Distant Voices programs, but one theme which has appeared in nearly every program has been the role of the Jews, either in our history or in our lives today. To a certain extent, that's been unavoidable because of the influence they have over current events through their control of the mass media and because of their historical role in communism. But it's more than that. What I've said in one way or another on several programs is that the Jewish role in our lives goes far beyond the fact that their control of the news and entertainment media gives them a big influence on popular culture and on the political process. Today I want to talk again about this Jewish role. I want to try to give you an overview of it first. There are about 14 million Jews in the world today, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica yearbook for 1997. Nearly half of those, about 6 million, are now in North America, where they make up just over 2% of the population, but wield far more influence than any other group. The world's 14 million Jews think and act like one big family, even though, like most families, they do a lot of arguing and squabbling among themselves. They go to different synagogues, Orthodox and Conservative and Reform, or to no synagogue at all. There are atheist Jews, and there are Jews who have converted to Christianity. There are capitalist Jews and communist Jews, homosexual Jews and heterosexual Jews. There are rich Jews and middle-class Jews and even a few poor Jews. But despite this apparent diversity, they do a better job of cooperating with each other and looking out for their common interests than any other ethnic group in the world. Why is this? Why are Jews more racially conscious than anyone else? Why are they so much more ready to collaborate with each other than members of other groups? Part of the reason is in their religion. It is an ethnocentric religion, a racist religion. Whereas Christianity and Islam, for example, are universalist religions, religions for anybody who chooses to believe in them, Judaism is not. Judaism is a religion only for the chosen people, only for the circumcised sons of Abraham. Jews are defined in terms of their bloodline, not in terms of their faith, which is why non-religious Jews like Freud or Trotsky or even Marx, the father of atheistic communism, are considered just as much Jews as the most pious synagogue goer with side locks and yarmulke. The non-religious Jews don't believe the hocus-pocus in their Torah or Old Testament, but they nevertheless are steeped in the folklore and traditions of Judaism. They are as familiar as their religious cousins are with the claims that Jews are a chosen people, destined to own all the world's wealth and be waited on hand and foot by non-Jews. And they are familiar with the tales of persecution from the time of the pharaohs until the time of Hitler, with the tradition of being universally hated by all the other peoples of the world, which is why they believe they are justified in avenging themselves on non-Jews whenever they have the opportunity. I'll not spend any time quoting Bible verses to you today, but if you doubt what I've just told you about the religious basis for Jewish ethnocentrism, just read the Old Testament, especially the five books of Moses and the book of Isaiah. Study them carefully. Even the Bowdlerized King James translation is pretty clear. If you really want to rub your nose in this subject, do some browsing in the Talmud.
In the Talmud, in Treatise Sanhedrin, an extensive passage describes the right of the Pharisee to kill anyone, just as long as he did so indirectly. As one of dozens of examples, the Talmud tells us that if one bound his neighbor and he died of starvation, he is not liable to execution. In such an indirect manner, the Pharisees also killed Christ. Manipulating the Romans to actually wield the spear and sword, the Pharisees claimed, as their descendants do today, that since the Romans were the direct cause of the death of Christ, it is the Romans, not the Jews, who are guilty.
This tendency of the Jews to stick together, always to favor their fellow Jews over non-Jews, and to work for the interests of their tribe instead of just for their individual interests, is a fact. A very enviable fact. It is the primary reason for their extraordinary level of wealth and power through the ages. You know, there are clubby little groups of white men who cooperate with each other to advance their interests. But those interests are personal and individual, not racial or even tribal. And virtually all of the really influential groups of this sort, the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, or groups of very rich and powerful men, corporate bosses or bankers, are in fact heavily larded with Jews. They're not racial groups at all, even if they don't have any blacks or Chinamen in them. They're simply special interest groups, whereas the 14 million Jews of the world form a huge, self-conscious racial interest group. They really are unique in this regard. I wish that our people had the same degree of racial consciousness the Jews do. The Jews understand the power of togetherness. Most of our people don't. And this is largely the reason why we're in the mess we're in today. The Jewish media bosses know what they want. It is control, not just of the media, but of us, of everything. They want to own us, and to the extent that they cannot own us, to destroy us. Unfortunately, I cannot play for you a secret recording of one of their summit meetings where they discuss their goals and their strategy, a la the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I can only offer you the historical record and common sense. The record, for those who have the eyes to see and an open mind, is pretty clear, beginning with the account in the book of Genesis of the takeover of Egypt by Joseph and his brothers so they could all, quote, eat the fat of the land, end quote, on through the ages to the Marxist takeover of Russia early in this century and the attempted takeover in many other countries. You know, the Germans didn't begin throwing the Jews out of Germany in the 1930s because of Christian bigotry. It was because they wanted their country back. The Germans wanted to run their own universities and schools, their own newspapers and films, their own legal and medical professions. If you want to understand the historical record, you must study it. I can't go through all of that for you in a half-hour program. I can only point the way. And as for the common sense aspect of understanding what the Jewish media bosses are up to, we just need to clear the cobwebs out of our heads and realize that every racially conscious group strives for mastery, for domination, not just the Jews. That's nature's way. That's the way it is in every barnyard and every schoolyard. And that is why the media propaganda takes the deliberate slant it does, trying to make us feel guilty, trying to kill our sense of racial consciousness while the Jews keep theirs, trying to persuade us to give up our arms, trying to silence all our dissident voices. Their aim is for us to be racially unconscious, for us to be ashamed of our nature and our traditions, for us to be afraid to organize for our common good, afraid of being thought racists. The deliberate aim of the Jewish media propaganda is to disarm us morally, to make us rootless and defenseless, and then to destroy us. That is what is happening now. Think about it, and you'll see how it all fits together. Thanks for being with me again today.